the most common questions that at least I've received, and I've heard it from other statisticians, that it's sample size. What sample size do I need? Now, the answer obviously has many different factors, and it is often constrained by practical elements like cost or the number of samples available, other uses for the samples, and even test facilities. You may not have the capacity to deal with as many samples as you would like. And elements of risk and cost and so on are not unknown to decision makers. And part of our role as a reliability engineer is dealing with, well, how many units do I need to test for life testing? And which is usually a fairly expensive endeavor. And so understanding the nuances of sample size calculations and being able to present not only a answer, but a way to adjust that answer, the number of samples, based on a discussion with the decision makers involved with either supporting or funding that particular test. So let's take a look a little closer at just basic sample size determination. All right, it's a common question, sample size. And what we're going to be looking for, and let me see if my next slide shows up all right. All right, yeah, it was looking bad there for a moment. All right, as I mentioned, it's a very common question, but it is one that we as reliability professionals and with our statistics involvement with our job, for lack of a better term, we're often asked, how many samples do I need? Now, I don't subscribe to the idea of just using whatever is in the standard, and I also don't subscribe to just using one sample if you don't have to. There's plenty of cases where you can learn quite a bit with just one sample, but if you're looking to determine a estimate about your population, then the sample and the number of samples you have need to capture the total amount of variation, or as much as you can, as you would expect in the population. And this isn't always possible or practical, yet it's one of the things that if you're using a sample to make a conclusion about the population, then there's a few simple things that you need to keep in mind as you design for how to collect those samples and also how many to collect. Now, the first consideration is random samples. So here's a couple of different examples of samples that I think have an error with them. So Bill selects 5 units each day to inspect, and he runs downstairs and into the factory, and he grabs 5 units. Now, what's wrong with that? Now, if we recalled the lesson in the note about how humans, our ability to find random samples, to select random samples, and our tendency is to pick stuff like 3 and 7, or if Bill's just picking 5 units from when he shows up on the line, those 5, are they representative of the variation that occurs through the day? Or of what he's interested in? Is it from line to line, or across the day during the line, or across the week, across the month? Does it include different lots, different materials, different so on? What variability are you trying to capture? And if it's, say, a continuous manufacturing process, and those 5 units might have been cut from one particular batch of production and will be very, very similar, yet very different from the next batch. So think through how your product is made and what causes the variability that you're interested in measuring, and adjust how you collect your sample appropriately. And then the second part, if you're trying to collect a random sample, which you almost certainly should be, then it's think through how you're going to collect that random sample such that it really is random. All right, and so it's related to what Jill's mistake is that if you take a unit every hour, is the cycle of your manufacturing associated with an hourly cycle or maybe every 24 hours or some other cyclic type behavior such that every hour you're getting a narrow slice of the variability that occurs within your product? So why every hour? And can you randomize that? Can it be every day you get a different schedule of when you go pick the production unit coming off the line? It may be more appropriate. You still can take the same number of samples, but what are you trying to protect? Now, if your samples are trying to make a statement or a judgment about the last hours of production, or the last hour of production, then taking a sample from that production over the last hour would make sense. But taking just one unit every hour and calling that a random sample is probably not true. And Sean, he's only looking at the stuff at the start of the reel. Now, that may or may not be appropriate. If you're working off of a 10,000 meter spool of material and they're cut into 100 meter lengths, that's still kind of a cyclic, same idea of what Jill is there a cyclic phenomena that occurs there? Or is the inspection being influenced just by what's easy to get to? And how do you know the variability that you're interested in is being captured? Is maybe 10 feet in would be more appropriate to inspect the jacket or some other location. And then Jean, she's only picking stuff from line A. Well, what about B, C, D, E, and F? Are they exactly the same? Well, probably not. So if you're interested in only information about line A, then that may be appropriate if you do everything else correctly. But my point here is that if you're going to take a sample, especially a random sample, you need to think through what's the range of sources of variability, whether it's different lines or different times a day or different operators, different batches of material that contribute to the variability that you're interested in monitoring. And you notice I'm using the word variability quite a bit here, because that's usually what we're interested in. It's the shifting of the values that we're measuring. And that's a variable. It varies. And so it's picking samples that allow us to make sure that we're getting a reasonable representation of the variability within the population. That's really the role of a sample. Another piece, and I'm pretty sure we're going to talk about this again in another lesson, more about reliability testing, but there's this concept of censoring. So if I'm measuring time data or time to failure type data, I have some units that have failed and some that haven't, there's a variety of terms that come into play as to what kind of censoring it is. And that plays a role into what kind of analysis we can do with the data. So right censoring, I'm going to use a little convention here that this is time zero. And we'll draw a starting line here for each of these. But right censoring is, it goes on and this one keeps running, and say that one failed and this one failed. So the right censoring is that I've collected my data at this point, but this particular unit hasn't failed yet. Now, I have two failures out of three, and one of them is run to the full length of time and hasn't failed. Now, we don't know if it's going to fail in the next instant. Maybe another minute or two after I pull the sample, it would fail, or if it would run for another 20 years. We don't know. We just know that it did successfully operate over that length of time. And so we can use that information, but we need to treat it as censored data. And we call it right censored because we don't know what's going to be out here. We don't know how much longer it will run, but we do know when it started. Right, left censored is we don't know when it started, and it's either continued to run to be right censored, or we don't know when it started and it continues to run and fails. So this side is a question. And this happens for, say, a medical practitioner, or you're looking at a product that you finally do a test to detect if it has a particular condition. What you don't know when you sense that condition is when it started. We just know that we noticed it today. Yet it may have been there for quite some time. So that would be one scenario where left sensoring occurs. Interval sensoring is a little different. Let's say I'm running a test and it's operating and it goes out here and fails. But I only can measure it at specific points in time. So I measure it here at point A and it's working. I measure it at B, it's working. C, it's working. D, it's not working. Now, I have to make a policy choice, basically. Do I treat this as it failed just after I put it back in the chamber, for example, and failed just after the last inspection, or it failed just before I measured it, or do I pick a midpoint? We don't know where it exactly failed, and we can be conservative, optimistic, or take the middle road and just put it in the middle. So that's interval sensory, and it's usually based on the way we can collect information about a product if we're measuring it every day or every week or on some interval. Multiple sensoring is just a collection of, it's either combinations of these other sensoring. It can be right sensored, left, or interval, or in combinations of these. And in that case, we would call it multiple sensoring. Right. So that sensoring piece seems a little out of place in this discussion for sample size, yet the quality of the data and the type of data that we're gathering makes a small difference in the overall collection of it. And it's a little beyond the scope here for these formulas I'll be talking about, but it is something to keep in mind, is what's the nature of the data you're collecting. The more sensoring you have, typically the more samples you're going to need. All right, sample size. So let's say I want to calculate N, the number of samples I need, and I'm going to run a hypothesis test. I'm comparing a vendor to a specification, for example. Well, I have a particular confidence that I want this sample to have some assurance that it's going to represent the population, you know, 0.95, 0.9, point whatever. It could be my confidence level. The alpha value then is the 1 minus that, 1 alpha equals 1 minus C. And then I have this Z value. And I'm using this as based on a normal distribution, but it's the whatever the appropriate underlying distribution is what's my probability factor here. And this is my chance that my sample actually represents the population. And so if this number is, if I take little risk, my confidence will go higher, say 0.99 or 0.999. That would increase this Z value and increase the number of samples. And you can see it's a squared value. So if I go from 0.9 to 0.95, it usually increases the sample size, well, according to a squared, rather significantly. The other number here, there's three numbers in each of these sample size calculations, or it's a part of the consideration, is the standard deviation, or sigma squared as being the variance. And that's the variation of the material of the population I'm dealing with. Now, oftentimes we make an estimate, and we call it S squared, but it's the spread of the data. And where that comes into play is that the more spread out the data is, the more samples we need, is because if my data has two populations that I'm comparing, and they're very spread out, or not very spread out, they're fairly tight, smaller standard deviations, then taking 2-3 samples from here and 2-3 samples from here is going to allow me to determine that they are different, if they are different. Get my screen back. Where on the other hand, get rid of those. On the other hand, if my two distributions are both very spread out, very large deviations, even though the mean values are probably the same as what I drew earlier, there's so much overlap that the probability of the sample coming from the blue curve or the green curve has this huge area of overlap. So the sample that I take from blue could be all right here. And the sample I take from the green could be all right here. And it makes it very difficult to detect that they're different. And so the bigger the standard deviations, or bigger the variance terms for the items that we're measuring, it's more difficult to get a small sample and detect a difference. Where if the standard deviations are very, very tight, very small, then it doesn't take as many samples to detect a difference, or mean variances, or mean difference. And then this E value. I like to say that's the factor of how much difference is enough to detect. So if I'm trying to determine, let's say I'm using a length measurement. If I need to measure something, and if it's within a foot of the of my specification, that's okay. And I can take some samples, and I make my measurements, and I'm good. But if I find out that I need to be accurate to within an inch, about an order of magnitude more precise, I'm going to need a significant higher number of samples. So this is the difference, or the precision term of sample size calculations. So if I'm measuring something and it's a length, and let's say it's 1 meter long, and I need to measure it, is it 1 meter or is it 2 meters? Well, and we can measure, I mean, the actual measurement itself and the measurement error is much, much smaller than those units. And so we can determine with one sample if the batch we're dealing with is at 1 meter or 2 meters, and pretty quickly. We could probably do it without even sampling, just take a look at it. One's twice the size of the other one. Where on the other hand, if it's 1 meter plus or minus 1 millimeter, and we need to sample the batch to find out if everything is within that specification of that length, well, then this number becomes very, very small relative to, say, the standard deviation value that we're dealing with the units we're dealing with. But as this number goes down, this goes up. And again, it's a squared function. So those are the three main criteria of it. I use hypothesis testing because it shows the three elements fairly clearly. So this formula is, what's my confidence? This is the type 1 confidence that my sample, what's the chance that my sample does not truly represent, due to random chance, the population. So my samples give me a value that is different than what the population values would give me. What's the spread of the data? And then what's the precision, or the difference that we're interested in? And so each of those play a factor in making the decision of how many samples we need. Now, we can also do this for a p-test, which is a proportions test. And it's, again, from a hypothesis test, which we've yet to talk about in any length. But it has the same three elements. It's what's my confidence, this p times 1 minus p is the variance term, and this delta p is how much difference in proportion of successes that I'm interested in. Same three elements. So another one is based on the binomial test, but it's based on a subset when there's no failures. So how many samples do I need to run, say, for a representative lifetime or an actual lifetime of a product? So let's say I'm doing button testing, and I know that this particular button, or you could use a connector or whatever, needs to work for 100 cycles. And that's what we would consider a lifetime for that product. And so M, in that case, if I'm actually running it 100 cycles, the test would be 100 cycles, but that equals one lifetime. So M is one. So M is the number of lifetimes. So if I run it half a lifetime, I need to run more samples. If I run twice the lifetime, I can use half the number of samples. It's pretty convenient in that way. If we know it's abated a Weibull distribution, then we can add the slope parameter here, and that modifies the term here. But that only really applies if I'm running a test more or less than one lifetime. One to any power is still going to be one, so it only really applies in the cases where you're running multiple lifetimes, is where it's more practical. And it gives you a bit more accurate information there. But once again, I've got the confidence realm, and I've got my factor of what am I interested in. And there isn't an obvious standard deviation term. This one takes a role of that. It's inversely related to that term, but it's not exactly the same. So my triad example there breaks down a little bit. But if you're going to do a life test, or you're evaluating a supplier that's doing a reliability test for you, and let's say they run 22 samples for something, right? Well, what does that mean, 22 samples? Well, if they're using a 90% confidence, so it'd be a alpha value of 0.1, or a 90% confident that the sample represents the population, and they run the test for one lifetime, so this essentially drops out of the equation, it means that they have at least 90% reliability. So it's 90% reliability with 90% confidence if all 22 samples operate for one lifetime without failure. If there's a failure, this calculation doesn't work anymore. You have to go back to the binomial distribution and chi-squared test analysis to find out what, you know, one failure out of 22 and when it occurred, and figure out from there what that actually means. But in designing the test or interpreting the results from somebody else, if they say they ran 11 samples and they want to claim that it has a 90% confidence, you can solve for R and figure out what's the lower limit of the reliability that they've demonstrated. And it goes down pretty quickly. So when you see somebody running 5 samples, for example, and say that proves that it's reliable enough, well, it shows that it's at least a certain value, but not much. It's not usually very high. It certainly doesn't represent that it's 100% chance that everything will last a lifetime. And so the sampling process impacts the way we interpret the results of the testing. So it's one way to think of it. So what's the right number of samples? It will change every time you calculate it. The formulas won't change, and the consideration constraints won't change, but sometimes the decision is very, very important. And so funds and resources and time is allotted to getting a good answer. So you may have hundreds of samples and dozens of chambers to handle the testing. In other cases, it's constraints and priorities are shifted to other areas, and so you only get 3 samples. And you're not going to be very statistically rigorous with just 3 samples. But if the standard deviations, the variance terms, are small enough, it may still be relatively significant. So in each case, you're going to have to do the due diligence and do the calculations and find out what is the appropriate number, and then balance it off of the constraints and the importance of making that of the correct decision. Those are good ways to approach a sample size calculation. So once again, I threw these in here every now and then to just remind you that a big part of this course is that you need to work the quizzes, work the sample exam questions, and work the examples too. Get very familiar through working those with your resources, your references, and especially the ones you plan on taking with you. And so that precludes Wikipedia, any online lookups, precludes using Excel for the calculations and those kinds of techniques. So practice, practice, practice using it the way you would have to during the exam. Once again, if you have any questions, just let me know. Next, we're going to dive into SPC and process capability. It's going to be a longer segment of the course, and there's a lot of material in there. SPC is often considered a part of the quality world and in manufacturing world, but it has a role in manufacturing, and it has a role in design, and it's one of those tools that allows us as reliability engineers to cross over into that quality world, especially when we're working with suppliers, that when they don't get it right and it affects the performance, especially latent defects in our product, that we want to get involved and make sure they have adequate process capability in order to make those products correctly. So we'll have a long discussion about SPC.